Is the learning in your school competency-based? Is it personalized? Is it happening anytime, anywhere? Is it student-owned? In other words, is the learning student-centered? And are all students learning more deeply, more equitably, and becoming career and college ready? If you have these questions, want to know what the research says about them, and are trying to figure out how to implement these ideas in your classrooms and schools, you've come to the right place. Thank you for listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Barriff, and I've been a principal and teacher in student-centered schools for over 17 years, and I can't wait to share a story or interview that will help you help your students. Today, we continue our series of very special episodes, 15 interviews of student-centered educators brought to us by guest producers. You're about to hear from Elizabeth Boucher, a second-year teacher at the Met High School in Rhode Island, and a candidate for a master's in urban education at Providence College. She interviews Matthew Girton, a quantitative reasoning specialist also at the Met, who talks to us about re-envisioning the high school math class as more relevant and student-centered. Enjoy this great interview.
Hi, this is Liz Boucher, and thank you for joining us on the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I am very lucky and honored to be with our guest today, Matthew Girton. Matt, would you mind telling us about where you work and what you do?
Sure. I work at the Metropolitan Regional Career and Technical Center in Providence, Rhode Island, but we'll be referring to it as the MET for short. And there I am a QR specialist, which stands for Quantitative Reasoning Specialist, which my main job is to teach the kids math, but also reasoning and problem solving.
So it's interesting that they call it QR, or quantitative reasoning, there instead of math. Can you kind of explain that a little bit more?
Sure. I would say in traditional settings, the main goal of a math class is to cover as much information as possible. And our priorities are to make the work more reflective of what students will be doing in the real world. And a lot of that is collaborative problem solving and working through larger open-ended problems instead of just routine exercises. So as much as we're teaching them math content, we're also teaching them how to reason with the content.
Awesome. So one of the reasons that I really wanted you to be on this podcast with me today was whenever I talk to people about student-centered learning, especially from different content areas, a lot of times the question comes up of like, well, that sounds very English-centric or history-centric. And people always question, like, how can I incorporate these practices into a math class? I've been privileged to see you teach before, and I think that you do a really good job with that. So I was wondering if you could kind of talk to us a little bit about what you do to make sure that the student is kind of the forefront in the classroom.
Sure. I would say my main priority with keeping students at the center of my teaching is to really give them opportunities to think in their own way and then focus any discussion we have around those thoughts. So a lot of the time people think math is very unidirectional. So there's one way to solve the problem, there's one strategy, and you just do that strategy and practice it. But what I try to do is to give problems that have several different paths to solving them and having all of those paths be viable options. So what kills me sometimes in some classrooms is like a student has their own way of solving a problem and then the teacher comes over and says, oh, no, that's not the way we're learning it. So giving students opportunity to use whatever methods they want, and then part of the end of the lesson, which we call the summarize phase, is taking all of those bits of learning and then being able to synthesize those into the content. So instead of the content coming from the textbook, it is then synthesized from all of the students' thoughts and thinking.
That sounds like a really cool way of going about it. And so the strategy that I've seen you use that I've always been really impressed by in the classroom is the three-act math. Mm-hmm. And so every time that I've seen that practiced, it really, you can see students thinking about the content in a very different way, kind of like how you were just explaining, how they can kind of go about their own routes. And I think that that kind of helps to solidify it. So can you just tell us, like, just what is three-act math?
Sure. So three-act math is a system developed by Dan Meyer, who is now an education professor, I believe, but he was a classroom teacher for a while before that. And the three-act math kind of stems from the Launch Explorer Summarize, which is a format for inquiry-based instruction. But the way it works is all of the problem is completely directed from student thinking. So it's not even a problem that's presented. So in the example that I just gave before, that could have been, you know, me telling the students, here is the problem that we're going to solve. But for three-act math, they're shown a video in their first task, which is act one, is for them to completely come up with the questions on their own. So instead of being told a question to solve, they're looking at this video. Usually it's like kind of weird and doesn't have a lot of explanation to it, and they have to come up with different math questions. So it could be like a hose filling up a swimming pool, and different questions could be like, how much water could it hold? How long will it take to fill? How much would it cost for the pool to be filled? And typically the tasks are made with certain questions in mind, but just having them develop those questions sometimes leads to like really interesting tangents of like, wait, how much money would it cost? A lot of the times I've completely rewritten what my plans were for the day just because of the questions that they came up with. And then act two, which is my favorite part, is there's no information given in the video. So with this hose filling up a pool, if we were just running with this example, there would be no information on how fast the water is coming out, how large the pool is, and they have to be the ones to ask for that information. So act two is asking students, what information do you need to solve the problem?
So what happens in the second act, if the students are asking for the information, what if they miss like a crucial piece?
This is why I like act two. So there's two things that can happen. The first is they don't ask for the information. Which I always almost hope that they don't ask for certain pieces, because I don't give it to them. I just let them start solving the problem, and hopefully as they're going through, there'll be a group or a few groups independently discover, oh, wait a minute, we need this other piece of info. So they can always stop me at any time and then ask a follow-up one. My other favorite is sometimes they ask for too much information, and you kind of need experience as a teacher to be able to make up information on the fly, but sometimes they'll ask completely irrelevant stuff, maybe not knowing it's irrelevant, but I'll just provide some random info to it. So they're like, what was the temperature on that day you were filling up the pool? Like, I don't know, 85 degrees, sure.
And so that was like really throw them sometimes where they're like stuck on that number of what do I do with this 85? Does that ever happen or?
Yeah, oh yeah, they the reason that I like it is it kind of models what would happen in an actual situation. Mm-hmm. So in the real world, you're not given like a perfectly contained set of parameters. You have a lot of information to deal with. So they're used to math problems. Every single piece of information is useful. So they try to incorporate it as much as possible. So that's like one way that I like it. And on the other hand too, there's also this expectation that if they're giving a problem, they already have all the information, and that there couldn't be any other missing ones. So it also models the situation when you're solving a problem and you're like, wait, we need more information to proceed. And this is all coming from their thinking throughout. And to finish it up, after they solve the problem, they usually work in groups collaboratively. I like to incorporate different spots where we all pause and people share out where they're going. Because sometimes some students are stuck and then they hear what another group is doing and they're like, oh, that's a much better strategy than what we have.
Mm-hmm. And so is solving it act three?
So solving it is like act 2.5. Ooh. Like really there's like four acts, but three is a nice number. So what act three is the video has a conclusion. So most of the times the video kind of gets cut short. So like a pool is being filled up and there's a little bit of a time lapse, but you only see like 1 or 2 hours of it. The third act, it shows the actual video, which sometimes, based on all the mathematical information, might not be exactly their answer. So it also brings up the situation of, even if you model with it mathematically, there's other factors that could play into changing the answer.
Interesting. So what is the biggest challenge for you as a teacher in, or maybe even like, what is your role? Because a lot of this is so student-centered where, yes, you're providing the information in Act Two, but what do you kind of do the rest of the time?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's weird because that's like, students are the ones doing most of the work, coming up with most of the thinking. I would say as a teacher, it's a lot more preparation, because not every problem is going to get students excited. So there's a lot of skill needed behind identifying problems that are juicy and have a lot of paths, planning out all the paths that could be possible. So instead of like coming up with an answer key, which you might do in a traditional lesson, you have to think about every possible way a student could solve this problem, because you want to be prepared to facilitate that thinking. I would say a mistake a lot of teachers make when first doing this process is stopping kids if they're doing something that they don't see as being familiar or efficient. So it's a lot more preparation up front. It's more complex preparation. In terms of the actual teaching part, it's a little bit scary, especially for new teachers, because you're completely handing over control of the lesson. So it's entirely possible that it's not a good problem. The kids aren't interested, and when you say, okay, go, they just are all lost or upset or just aren't motivated to solve the problem. But I would say the majority of the time, if you have a good problem, during that part, instead of teaching, you're just facilitating the thinking. So it's a lot of asking questions. Usually during that part, I only ask questions. So I'll go around and I'll say, oh, okay, so what information do you think is useful? What do you think that means? What can you do with that? Ah, I see you started something there. What's the next step? So it's a lot of those pieces, and I would say the big responsibility is synthesizing the student thoughts into kind of a cohesive package that then becomes the main lesson for the day, which is, I think, where most other, more like traditional setups, more direct instruction starts. You start with the, here's the big idea. Mm-hmm. Now let's look at examples. And this other way is like, here's kind of the examples where it shows up, and then synthesize it to make the big idea.
Which I'm sure makes them more invested once they get to that lesson piece. Because, I mean, a lot of times for students to sit down and listen to straight lecture for a while and they're like, I don't even know what the context of this is going to be later. Whereas now they've had an opportunity to play with it, kind of get frustrated by it, and then like need to know that answer.
Yeah, and the frustration part is actually a really useful tool. Dan Meyer, who once again is the man who created the three-act math system, in one of his talks, he talked about having math be like the ibuprofen for frustration. So you present a problem, and without math or without refined mathematical thinking, it kind of gives you a headache because you're like, how do I approach this problem? But having that summarized phase is like the big aha of like, oh, I could just like make this equation and do three steps, and that thing that took me 45 minutes can take me 3 minutes. So You're absolutely right. The context makes the kind of the big reveal a lot more meaningful. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you started the lesson with like, here is a theorem, it's completely vacuous. Like students typically have no idea like what it'll be used for or why. So this way it adds a lot more meaning to the material.
And so I know you teach high school. Have you ever seen or do you know about this method being used in other grades, or could you see the application for younger grades, or do you think it's too...
Yeah, so on Dan Meyer's site, he has a lot of, like, a whole bunch of different videos, and I seen them go down to, like, third grade.
Oh, wow.
So it's widely applicable. I would say in high school, you can get away with having students work for the whole class duration. Mm-hmm. I would say one of the changes for middle school down to elementary school is having the tasks be a bit more bite-sized. Mm-hmm. So typically the ones that we use in high school, I dedicate a whole class time to it, but in elementary school it might be more of like 15-20 minute piece.
Well, I imagine that this way also allows for a lot of differentiation too, because students usually work in groups, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a group that kind of like gets it quickly, you can maybe pose another question on top of that, and that I would assume like allows a little bit more challenge and also like the ability to slow down for the students who aren't getting it as quickly. So I don't know, maybe what do you do in those situations where you have like that one group that finishes super fast and that other group that's really struggling? Like, is it case by case or?
Yeah, so I'll give an example. So one of the three-act math tasks that I really like is it shows a leaking faucet just dripping, and I pose the question, how much money will this cost if this goes on for a year? Which it's really funny to hear students' estimations for that. I think one student said it would cost $2 million if your faucet leaked. I think in actuality, the actual answer is like $3 to $4. It's pretty small. But I had one of the questions.
Now all the kids are going to be wasting water.
I put the faucet on when it's happening, and they get very concerned. I had, usually the question comes up of how much will it cost if the faucet's on like full blast, or like if you're taking a shower. So I had a group that finished this task pretty quickly, and I had a measuring cup, and I said, figure out how much it would cost if it was running on full blast. So they went to the different sinks in the school and like took average measurements and had this whole other piece that was generated from their own question. If students don't have questions that could be easily pursued, typically these three-act math tasks always have an extension to them. Mm. It's called like the sequel. So, and in terms of students who struggle more, the piece that I like about it is they're not trying to fit themselves into a mold. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, here's the strategy you have to apply. They can really start by their own thinking. And a lot of these problems can be done visually. A lot of them can be done like with tables. The quality of the problem really helps with the differentiation. And if it's a good problem, any student can access it. Mm. So at the Met, we have our 9th and 10th grade classes, for the most part, are completely mixed ability-wise. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of success with this. And students who excel in math typically excel in very like rote memorization sort of math. So getting an open-ended problem really tosses them like in a different direction. They want to have be able to solve it in one or two steps. And a lot of these, that's not the case. And it also gives students a chance to get away from what looks like typical mathiness. And a lot of them have like these math phobias that really impact their motivation by the time they get to high school. So all my students really, really enjoy it.
Yeah, and full disclosure, I'm also an advisor at the Met. So I've had students go through your class and go through three-act math and then take the content that they learned and apply it to their own work at their internships or with their projects, which is kind of one of the focal points of the Met as well. So I think it's a really cool way of allowing students that real-life problem solving while still keeping the content heavy. Then I know a lot of people, when we talk about student-centered learning in math, really get concerned and really nervous about, like, how can I be sure that I'm meeting my content requirements? And I really like this method because I really think it does both. And I see a high level of engagement from students, and then, like I said, a lot of transfer of those skills into what it is that they're doing.
Yeah, and they remember it, which mm-hmm. which is always
awesome.
So instead of saying like, "Hey, remember that time when we learned the Pythagorean theorem?" No, it's like,
"Hey,
remember
across the beach, right?"
Yeah, the taco cart. Yeah, they always remember taco cart. So it gives them a good anchor to like base it in. And a lot of the times, when I'm teaching a topic that's related to it, I'm like, "Just think back to the taco cart," and they're like, "Okay, got it."
Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Matt. And I have to say, I've seen you do Dan Myers, which I want to get you to spell out his name and give everyone his resource as well. But you've done a great job with making your own three-act math videos that are really fun, too. So I highly encourage anyone who's interested in this method, definitely check out what Dan Myers has and then kind of play around with the method yourself and see if you can come up with some fun problems. And I think he has an option where you can share your videos on there too, doesn't he?
Yeah. It's kind of like making a database, and you know, if you're savvy with video equipment, if you make it about yourself or the students, they love it.
They love
it. It's funny. Most of the videos show just like hands, and every time I show it, they're like, "Is that your sink? Are those your hands?" And then I say yes.
All right, well, thank you again. And can you just spell out Dan Meyer's name or give us the link to the website?
Yeah, if you just Google search Dan Meyer, which is DanMeyer, and he has a whole website with three-act math and a whole bunch of other really cool student-centered resources.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time, Matt. I really appreciate it. I think that this was a really cool look into that strategy. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thank you again for listening to the Student Centered Learning Podcast. Let us know what you think about this episode or what you tried in your school by commenting on our Facebook page. You can also subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, and please leave a rating so others can find us. You can also follow us on Twitter at STUCNTRPodcast. And remember, students learn deeply when they are at the center.